Denise Chanterelle Dubois has lived an outrageous life, right out of a TV show like Narcos or Orange is the New Black. A closeted trans woman in the 80s, Denise was a cocaine dealer in Southern California until she got caught with a kilo, went to prison, and then managed to get out after serving only 4.5 months.
In her new memoir, Self-Made Woman, Denise takes us on a roller coaster ride through her adventures as a transgender gal surviving drug addiction, alcoholism, car crashes, risky sex, and life behind bars. Listen as Denise Chanterelle Dubois joins us to talk about her life as a cocaine dealer, being a tour guide in Costa Rica, and why she handed out donut holes to the public to celebrate a major trans victory.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
The clock is ticking. Time is running out. We have until October 19th at 10 p.m. to fund the Kickstarter to save Cooking with Drag Queens. A magical look at the lives of extraordinary performers and food. Please pledge today at cookingwithdragqueens.com or the series is toast.
Our guest today is author Denise Chanterelle Dubois, whose new memoir, Self-Made Woman, tells the amazing story of her adventures in life, surviving drug addiction, alcoholism, car crashes, risky sex, and prison. Atta girl. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate being on your show.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Thank you.
You describe yourself in your book as fortune's favorite daughter. Why is this lady so lucky?
I came close so many times in my life to being dead, not only with bullets flying through the air, but the copious amounts of alcohol I drank. I drank enough to sink a battleship, smoked enough weed to burn down a Midwest cornfield. I took enough pills and LSD and was doing speedballs in Milwaukee, Wisconsin when I was 19 years old before John Belushi even knew what a speedball was. I could have overdosed so many times. I could have been dead so many times. In fact, there are times when I kind of wonder if I really didn't survive and if I may be in a nursing home with a brain contusion and a feeding tube down me and this is all a figment of my imagination.
Do you want me to pinch you to make sure it's real?
you might want to try that, but no. I've always considered myself fortune's favorite daughter because I had so many close calls and I made it. I'm here. I'm with you tonight. This is wonderful. Yeah,
it's really extraordinary to have you here in the home studio. Tell us about the circumstances on how you went to prison, because I really feel like, especially with the success of Orange is the New Black and author Piper Kierman's memoirs and blog, there's a renewed fascination and interest in women going to prison and trans women stories.
It was a very sad part of my life, what happened to me. Mm-hmm. I got into dealing pot in San Diego in the mid to late 70s. It was an easy way to make money. I was working at Safeway, actually, at the time. It was a part-time position. And I knew people who had pounds of weed. And back then, it was Sensimian or Thai Stick. And
Thai Stick.
You know, they were friends of mine, and I would go over and get high with them. And then one day, I happened to mention to them that I knew somebody that needed 3 pounds of weed. And they said, oh, here, take it. I went, what do you mean, take it? They said, take it. We'll front this to you, and you can go ahead and get that over to them and pay us later. I went, really? And it worked. I took 3 pounds of weed over to this person's house. They paid me cash. I made something like $300 for 15 minutes worth of work. And I was hooked. I thought, wow, this is a really nice way to make money. What typically happens in these kind of situations are you can move along in this world and move into other realms of dealing. And at that time in San Diego in the late 70s, it was Escobar's blow. It was everywhere in San Diego. It was not unusual to go to a party and see like something out of an Eagles song. Lines on the mirror, lines on your faces. There was cocaine everywhere. it was very typical, instead of, well, along with drinking, to always be snorting cocaine. It's just the way it rolled. And I found that kind of interesting. I had an allergy to cocaine, so I really couldn't do it. So I was really the perfect seller for cocaine.
Because what, if you snorted cocaine, it would give you the hives? Or
no, my nose would plug up for really bad, and it was I just couldn't do it.
So it's something
so
you were not interested
in? Instead?
I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Mark.
So you smoked it instead? Or
no, I just didn't do it. I did other drugs.
what was your drug of choice at the time?
It was always speed for me. If I could get a whole
methamphetamine pills?
Well, it wasn't called methamphetamine back then. It was called crank.
Crank.
And if I could get pharmaceutical pills of speed, bioamphetamine, for example, in my earlier years when I was still on the... I like to tell people I was born on the west coast of Lake Michigan. I in Milwaukee was able to get pharmaceutical speed. I was hooked early on, age 18, 19. So when I went to San Diego, I always was on the lookout for that. And then I ran across crank. That was always my drug of choice. It lasted longer, made me feel real sexual.
It made you horny.
It made me very horny.
Okay.
It made me very horny.
So your sex life was good?
With myself.
Okay. You're like, I'm the hottest bitch in town.
Yeah.
And so as you were sort of like discovering your sexuality, your gender identity, and sort of a very, you know, dangerous way to make money in the 1970s you're talking about.
Yeah, 78, 79, 80, right in there.
And you are telling yourself, Denise, get out of this. This is going to get you in jail. This is going to get you in trouble.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I have really good radar, I call it. And when my radar goes off, I usually listen to it. And in this case, I didn't. The attraction of selling cocaine and cutting it with manite and doubling your profit overnight, tripling your profit overnight was too tempting. The money was too fast and too good. And I got sucked into it. And what was normal back then in those times was, it was a big front game. It was like a shell game. So I would get a front from my people, then I would turn around and front that to people I knew.
So it was like Amway was a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, basically. And then I would go around and collect, but it was a slippery slope because you never quite got back what you fronted out. So you'd end up fronting again. And letting him get away with it. My radar was like all over the map on this. Like, this is not working. You should get out of this business. It just wasn't a practical business model.
And so one day you're driving, you actually had a car with your passport and some money and some clothes so you can make a getaway.
Yeah, let me tell you what happened. I had a dealer up in L.A. who moved quite a bit of blow. That's what I called it, and everyone called it back then. I had been working with this person for about 3 years. I trusted him. He he always paid his bills with me. He seemed on the up and up. Well, out of the blue, one day, he said, I've got some really cool people that I want to introduce you to, and they can move a lot more product than I can. And I went, really? You know, who are these people? Well, they're good friends of mine. They're down in San Diego where you are. I went, well, that's even better. I don't have to be coming up to L.A. and going through that stupid border checkpoint on I-5 between and San Clemente. And so I trusted this guy, of course. I come on down to San Diego, and he introduces me to a couple of people. They were hippie-looking, like me, back then. They seemed on the up and up. They were very interested in seeing what kind of cocaine I had, and they wanted an 8-ball. It was called an 8-ball back then, which is 3.5 grams, which is a typical, you know, sold for about $350 back then.
So it was like the movie amount. Like,
yeah,
when they do drugs in movies, that's what they pull out.
That's what they pull out, yeah. You know, and I was happy to procure that. That was not a problem, and I actually had that in inventory. They loved it. They loved it. So they started talking me up the ladder, you know, with this person. Al was his name, who introduced me to these people, and he was kind of in on it in the beginning. Introduced me to these people. We kind of got things rolling. They made the buy. And I was ready to move forward with all this. So right away, they started talking kilos of blow. And I kind of put the kibosh on that. You know, I didn't really know these people that well. And that was the first inkling that I had that something wasn't quite right here.
Uh-huh.
because they're new and they're already talking to me about kilos of blow. And the person that introduced me to them never did a kilo of blow. He always did quarters. Mm. And all of a sudden we're talking kilos. And I was a little bit apprehensive, and I would get a hold of Al and I'd say, hey, these guys want to do kilos, man. Are you sure about this? And he would totally calm me down. Like I said, I trusted this guy. He was cool. I went along with it, even though I overrode my radar, essentially. So we move along with the process. They want a couple kilos of blow to move this thing up. They talked about getting even more beyond that. So I bring the person in who owns the cocaine into this whole process. And he meets with them and me. So now I got a new problem on my hands because I don't really own this blow. The guy that I brought in owns the blow. They are the buyers. And by me putting them together, one of the golden rules in this kind of business is you don't put those kind of people together and make yourself, you're not indispensable anymore.
It makes you obsolete.
I'm obsolete.
Yeah. They can kill you off.
Yeah, they can do business without me. Yeah. And I'm being cut out, it's called. Mm-hmm. So I was desperate to not let that happen. So I tried to facilitate this to make sure the deal came down at my house. It was for, they wanted more than 1 kilo, and we talked them down to 1 kilo. Okay? One kilo.
Because the more they had you buy, or the more they could buy, the more they could charge you.
And the more risk.
Yeah, and the more. And we this came from the guy that owned the blow. You know, I said, that's a good idea. Let's not go so big in the beginning, even though the greed factor is there, because you want to make the money and everything. So we slowed the whole thing down. They were still interested. They kind of went away for a week or so. I couldn't get a hold of this guy. And that was the second warning that I got. My radar clicked on again. I'm like, he's not answering the phone. Where'd this guy go? This doesn't make any sense. I don't like, you know. And then the greed factor takes over again, and you calm yourself down. Finally, this guy answers the phone. He wants to do the deal and everything. So I get my person involved with this again. So the night that I went down, popped, busted, whatever you want to call it, it was very bizarre. This person that I know comes over with not 1 kilo of blow, but 2 kilos of blow. And I go, what are you doing with 2 kilos? I only want one. He goes, oh, no, I got this great idea. I go, really? What? He goes, we don't really know these people that well. I still want to do the deal. But what we're going to do, because they were going to send Al over on his own.
Who's Al again?
Al's the guy that introduced me to this whole thing.
Yeah.
And Al said he's going to come over and test it and then go get him. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Why don't you just come over with them? Oh, no, they don't want to do that. They don't want to. Again, my radar's clicking on. Nothing.
They're setting you up.
They're setting me up.
Yeah.
They're setting me up. So I go, well, okay. You know, okay, okay. So Al comes over. He tests the cocaine. Goes, nice. He leaves. I mean, he goes, oh, and by the way, Why don't you come with me? I'll be back in a few minutes. And they want to show you the money. And I'm They want to show me the money. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, they got a guy waiting in the car, and he wants to open, and he just wants to make you feel comfortable. He wants to show you the money. I went, I don't need to see the money. You and I have known each other for years.
Yeah.
So I went, okay, all right. But because my radar had been clicking on so much through this process, I had actually parked my car 3 blocks away from my house, and I had put my passport in there with a bunch of cash because I was so suspicious of this thing not going right that I was ready to bolt at a heartbeat and drive to TJ, Tijuana, get into Mexico. That's how much my radar was warning me over this whole situation.
What made you not want to just bail out immediately?
Greed.
So how much money are we talking here that was at stake?
100 grand, somewhere around there.
And how much of that would you have been able to keep?
Probably about $4,000 at the time, which to me was a lot of money. It would have helped me with all the fronts that I had out there that people weren't paying me, so I could get all caught back up on that. And then there was the potential of these people, like, they talked 5 and 10 kilos. And I thought, man, I'm making it.
You could have been the transgender Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, right. So I'm like, the greed really takes over. You know, plus, what really clouded my judgment was, I don't know if anyone here recalls Quaaludes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. Back then, Quaaludes were huge.
For people who may not be familiar, Quaaludes were sort of a barbiturate.
They were downers.
They were a downer, like a heroin, but in pill form.
They were called lemons. They were made by Lemon Company Pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. 714s was another nickname for them. I was also dealing lewds. That was the nickname for them.
So it was the OxyContin of its day.
Yeah, yeah. And I was popping those like candy that night.
Oh, jeez.
Drinking beer with it. So my judgment was like, I was like so nervous I was taking lewds. So in retrospect...
Did you have a weapon? Did you have a gun or anything like that?
I haven't gotten to that part yet.
Okay. I'm like, I'm thinking like you were packing heat probably.
So... Yeah. So... I go, okay, all right. And I have my car stashed and everything. And so Al comes back. There's a soft knock at the door. It's Al. He goes, come on. We go out into the San Diego night, walk a half a block, and there's this beat-up car. And there's this guy sitting there behind the steering wheel, and he's got long hair and a handlebar mustache. And the way he looked at me, I just said to myself, this guy's a cop. There's no doubt this guy is a cop. And then he pops open this briefcase next to him, and he's got stacks of hundreds. Like, I'm going to count it? And I go, I go, oh, I pick up one stack, and I kind of thumb through it like something out of a movie. Sure. And I go, yeah, looks good. What else was I supposed to say?
What would have been the right thing to do to make the drug deal not feel creepy and you know... Have your radar go off.
The way it should have come down is if Al was really tight with these people, if
you would have never seen any money.
There would be no money show. Sure. These guys would have come over. It would have been casual. It would have been have a few beers. It would have been relaxed, smoke a joint or two. You want to lewd, chill out, and then get down to business, take care of things. Boom, over with, gone. That kind of deal. So the money show's over. And this is where I had the opportunity to bolt. Because I'm walking back to my house by myself. Al left. He goes, I got to go. Where are you going? I'm going to go get the other undercover agent. His name was Brian. I have to go get Brian. I'm like, what? And I'm like, no, I'm looted out. So my judgment's off. I'm walking back to my house. And once again, for the last time, my radar clicks on really strong. This is your last chance. Don't let greed take you over. Get to your car and get the hell out of here. It's over. These are all cops.
Sure.
And I didn't listen.
But you wanted to get caught in some degree?
No, I didn't want to get caught. I just didn't trust my gut like I should have.
Sure.
So I get back to my house. The guy that I'm working with is there. He's a little nervous. He goes, you got a lewd? I go, yeah, give him a lewd. Crack another couple beers. He goes, what's happening? I go, they're coming now. They're coming with the money. Brian and his partner. And he goes, well, where are they? I go, they'll be here any minute. So he goes, okay. And then I said, well, what about what's with the 2 kilos, going back to the 2 kilos? Oh, here's my plan. He goes, this is a fake kilo. It was talcum powder. And he goes, so what we're going to do now that Al tried the real blow is we're going to hide the real blow. And I had this secret compartment in my closet with a trap door that opened up into a space behind my closet. So we stashed the real blow behind the closet door and put the fake blow, the talcum powder blow, on the coffee table in my living room just as a precaution in case this wasn't right. Like, it wasn't really a real brilliant idea when you think about it, because if they were cops, and of course they were, they're going to find the real blow anyway. But it was pretty funny what happened. I mean, it wasn't funny at the time. So a few minutes later, there's the soft knock again at my back door. And I go, man, we give each other the high five. This is it. This is it. This is great, you know. I unbolt all my deadbolts. I answer the door. And I look, and there's like four guys with 45s pointed at me, a shotgun, and an AR-15. And they scream at me, down! And they were all long-haired hippies, and I thought we were being robbed. And they throw me to the floor, and then they handcuff me, and they throw a search warrant in front of my face. And I said to myself, I went, F, you know what I mean by that, cops. I knew it, and they were cops. He had totally set me up. I was already a goner the second I did that controlled buy of the 8th, because that gave them justification to get a federal bench warrant to do all the setup work that they had done after that moment. These guys were wired every time they met with me. Being wired means they had hidden microphones on them.
Audio recordings.
Yeah. So sure. They would ask me leading questions during this whole process leading up to that night. And I asked them about Quaalude. You guys want lewds? I can get 5,000 lemon lots for you.
You're bragging.
I was bragging. I've done hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of business with Tom, the guy that was higher up from me. Really, and I was bragging for a reason. I wanted them to impress them because I didn't want to get cut out.
Mm. Man. So you're being through the legal system. Who represented you in court and the judge and?
Well, I had a public defender initially, and it wasn't a very good situation for me because Tom got out right away. I was taken to the Metropolitan Correctional Center, and I'm transgender. I'm wearing a bra and panties under my clothes. Mm-hmm.
They called you, when they arrested you, they called you something I hadn't
dink.
Heard before. Dink.
Dink.
Had you ever? You
no, I never heard of that.
Was it an acronym or something?
I don't know what it meant. That's just what they were laughing in my bedroom because they found all my clothes and all my magazines, wigs, makeup, things like that.
Did you present as a
woman? Closet case.
So you weren't out as
not
trans at the
not
time?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. They loved it.
They would have thought of you as like a cross-dresser because you presented as male, but then you had like...
They had a field day with me. It was funny, too, when they thought they had the real blow. They took it into my bedroom. They went, yeah. And they started testing, and then I hear one of them go, fuck, it's fake. And they came running out to the living room, and they were furious with me, and I'm handcuffed.
Sure.
And I'm high on lewds, and they said, what's going on? I go, I don't know what you're talking about. And they dragged me into my bedroom. What is this? I go, I don't know. Where's the real stuff? I go, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, they eventually brought a dog in. So the dog goes right for the back of the closet. Mm. What they didn't know was when this was installed, there was a pressure plate that if you pressed on it, a red light would go on and start blinking. That way I knew that when I was gone, if someone had come into my house and set off the pressure plate. Mm-hmm. So when that happened, the dog set that off. They thought it was a bomb.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. They thought I had my place wired for a bomb. They go, what's going on, man? I go, and is this a bomb? I go, maybe. Oh, man, I was really, really arrogant. I was so angry because they were slamming, so I slammed them back. Anyway, they got the real blow. But getting back to your stories, and I'm on my way to the Metropolitan Correctional Center in the back of a San Diego squad car. The cop in the front seat, the San Diego police officer, goes, you're very fortunate that this is a federal bus, because otherwise you'd be going to the county jail. Mm. And he says, it's a lot worse there. You're going to the MCC, Metropolitan Correctional Center. It was nicknamed the Mexican Country Club, because there were so many illegal alien coyotes there who were running aliens up from San Diego. So it was different floors and everything, carpeted, cell, things like that. So on the way there, I get this brilliant idea. I don't want anyone to know I'm transgender. I know I'm going to be strip searched. I'm scared. So I get there.
What were they going to find?
Well, my bra and panties, things like that. Sure. I'm nervous. I've got these tattoos on my ass that say I'm a fool for women. When I was high on crank, I would go into tattoo parlors and get all this stuff done to me. Mm. I had such low self-esteem. I'm so embarrassed about myself and humiliated about myself. I would do these things to myself. So I get there, and they take you through medical processing, and the nurse starts asking me questions, and she goes, well, how do you feel right now? I go, I'm suicidal. Yeah. She goes, are you sure? I go, absolutely, because I knew that meant I would not go into the general population. What I didn't know was I would be thrown into isolation and fed through a trap door.
Yeah, and it's very much similar to the circumstances that
Chelsea Manning's
been through.
Yeah. And I was on suicide watch, and they had a little trap door that they fed me through.
And what year are we talking? This is the mid-80s now.
This is 1983. Yeah, okay. 1983.
At the height of the drug war.
Oh, yeah. This was it. This is at the peak.
They were ready to throw you in prison and throw away the key.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
And surprisingly, you spent how many years in prison?
No. I was only in for about 5 months.
5 months?
Here's what happened. As I mentioned, everyone else got out that was regarding my case. They had money. They abandoned me. And I had a therapist friend who would come and visit me from the outside. And he said, you know, it was Dennis then. You know, Dennis, no one's going to help you but yourself now. And I know a guy, his name is Ben, who is in a situation like you're in with a lot more volume, and he's out, and he wants to come and talk to you. Because if you're willing to cooperate, they can get you out. And he said, it's up to you, but everyone else has abandoned you. You're on your own in here. You have a public defender that isn't doing her job for you, and she wasn't. It's your call. You can stay in here, and whatever happens,
spend the rest of your life in prison.
Yeah, because I had a federal judge who was known as five and dime, which means 5 or 10 years for people at my level with cocaine. Transgender, 5 to 10 years in prison. I finally just said, okay, I want to meet with this guy. He came in, talked to me. He got the ball rolling. I met with the DEA. They took me out across the street for the first time. I was outside on the street. I wasn't handcuffed. I was like, oh my God. They got me out right away. So the first part of the situation was I had to be willing to agree to testify against the person who owned the cocaine, because he got a high-powered attorney to represent him, and he was going to go to trial over all of this. So my job was to testify against him, and what happened?
Against Al?
No, against Tom, because Al was an informant.
Okay.
I remember Al turned me in for cash to the DEA. So it was very interesting the way this all came down. Eventually, I did testify against Tom in court. Louis Wenzel, he's still practicing law in San Diego, was Tom's attorney. And Louis Wenzel, years earlier, was a state judge on the state bench. And he had been popped for using state credit cards to hire prostitutes who would urinate on him. I'm not making any of this up. This is the real deal, man.
Listen, I believe you 100%.
This is the real deal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when that all came out in the San Diego Union, this is, you know, long before I went down, I felt so sorry for that guy. He had to resign his position as a judge. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, because I was a kinkster, and I thought, you know, it shouldn't have to be this way. He's really taking it, you know, he paid his bills. What difference does it make? It just was a slip of whatever. And they went after him. They, you know, forced him to resign. So he ends up being the guy against me in court. So what he tried to do when I appeared in court and testified is he tried to humiliate me on the bench. He goes, but, you know, the DA, the USDA.
They tried to discredit you by bringing up the fact that you're trans.
Yeah, yeah. So the USDA, who was now on my side, warned me about this. And he said, kind of coached me on what you might want to say, but he said, don't worry, Gordon Thompson, you know, the federal judge is going to stop him from really getting too far with that. But he was able to get some questions in, and he goes, so, Dennis, do you wear women's clothes? You know, I'm like, wow, this guy's really going for it. And finally, I just said, right on the stand, I said, you know, Mr. Wenzel, if anyone should know the aberrations of human sexuality, I think it would be you.
And what did he say to that?
It was great. It was the best thing I could have said. I was on the stand for maybe 10 minutes max, and I was out of there.
I'm just always surprised that, and I've never been in this situation, so it's hard for me to, but, you know, whenever someone's, like, being asked a question that's very self-incriminating or putting them in a dangerous situation, in a lawsuit, in a testimonial, in a deposition even, why not just answer, like, what does that have to do with this case?
Exactly. And he made an effort.
But did that cross your mind to answer
sure
in that approach?
It sure did. But I knew that the USDA was on my side, and I knew the federal judge would be on my side. And that's exactly what happened. You know, that was the only question he got in on it. The federal judge then gaveled and said he was out of order and he couldn't pursue that line of questioning.
Denise, for the months that you were in prison, it was always in isolation? Or did you actually?
No, I got out of that. And I would just sit around on the medical floor because I was out of the psych ward. Then I would sit around at the tables there and smoke cigarettes and occasionally play a little pool. I knew I was going to get sent into the general population at any moment. And then one of the inmates, or this was the trustee level where they had all the intake for x-rays and things like that and interviews, he said, hey, I'll give you a little hint. He said, you're sitting around here a lot. He goes, you really want to stay on this floor? And I went, yeah, what do I have to do? Start working. show them that you belong here. And they won't send you into the general population. They need people that they can trust here. Show them that they can trust. I started working my rear end off every day.
So, like,
day.
mopping or something?
Mopping, cleaning toilets, anything.
Just off? So you were volunteering just
volunteering,
to clean?
And they noticed me, and they kept me on that floor. But there was one thing that also kept me on that floor. The head psychologist for the state of California came and talked to me. Because, you know, they all knew about my situation, closet case, that kind of stuff. And I told him about my tattoos. And he said, well, that's really not a reason to keep you on this floor. We need to get you into the general. He was ready to send me. And I said, well, would you like to see those? He goes, yeah. So I pulled on my pants and showed my ass to this guy. And he goes, we're going to keep you on this floor.
Wow. So
what is your tattoos? Is that before for women?
Now I kind of want to see your tattoos.
They're gone. They're gone. I got Merlin and the dolphins all over that now.
Oh. And so just by testifying, that was enough to get you out? Or did you have to do some more stuff for them?
No. I was in the simultaneously while testifying. I also had to help them with a case and help set up a guy. He owed me tons of money. And when I got out, I went and saw him independent of them and tried to get him to pay me some money. I was broke. But of course, he didn't have any money to pay me. And he was like, you know, look, you got more? That's all he wanted. So I didn't have really any qualms about getting involved on that. So now I'm wired. I'm a confidential informant. And I'm introducing him to agents who were also wired. He wasn't that big of a fish, so they were only get 2 or 3 ounces out of him. I don't know what happened to him after that.
What's interesting, because you were kind of introduced to the criminal life at a young age, growing up in Wisconsin. Your parents used to take you across the border to buy, of all things, Oleo.
That's correct.
Oleo is margarine.
It's margarine, yes, which was illegal in the state of Wisconsin because they produce so much butter there.
That's yeah, right. In the early days of margarine, they used to dye it pink so people wouldn't confuse it for butter. And originally, margarine was developed to make turkeys fat.
But it killed the turkeys.
It killed the turkeys, so they're like, let's feed it to people.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite an adventure going to the state line to get cases of Oleo.
And then your parents would distribute it to other people?
Yeah, yeah.
It seems unfathomable at this day and age.
Why did people in the 60s are so excited about Oleo, margarine?
It was cheaper.
It was also because they thought it was less fattening.
That was part of it, too.
Yeah. But at least my aunt was into that. She was margarine is great. You don't put on any pounds.
And it's better for your heart. And now they've discovered it's the exact opposite.
It's the exact opposite. Now, it was all about the money for my parents. Yeah.
It was like a bootlegging Diet Coke.
It was. Because it was hilarious.
This was a Pepsi County.
It was hilarious.
Huh. So you're getting out of jail. You're at what point in your timeline here are you going into recovery? What kind of a job and industry did you get to get your life back on track? Because you got married later in life.
Yeah, I was married in June of 1988. This all was behind me by the end of 84. I was sentenced. I got a 5-year suspended federal sentence. 5 years federal probation. I cleaned up my act. I got a job as a tour guide in San Diego, corporate tourism. That served me well later in corporate groups. And when I lived in Costa Rica many years later, I started my own company. I went through that process, and then I ended up at the Old Globe Theater as a marketing assistant, which is a Equity House Theater in San Diego in Balboa Park. And I learned a really good business program there, and I met my future wife at the Globe. I got cut.
She was an actress at the time?
No, she was an intern, a PR intern from Ohio University, and I was cut loose from federal probation after only 2.5 years. They just cut me loose. They said, you know, you're done. You're fine.
We don't want to see you anymore.
We got a lot more heavier people to worry about than you. You're done. They actually came to my house and looked around and said, you're done after that. It was really cool. Very happy about that. So I went with my wife to Portland, Oregon, and ended up with the Symphony for many years. I created my own position there as director of audience development. That same program I had learned at the Old Globe, I was able to forge my own position with the symphony.
So you kind of became a drug dealer for culture.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that. You could say that. I fell
like
deeply.
I got some symphony here. Yeah. I got sweet beats.
Yeah. Ended up falling deeply in love with my ex-wife. And when we got married, of course, I told her all about my past and all the things that had happened to me. But I said, you know, hon, it's all behind me now. It's over with. I love you. And I did. And
you're talking about, at that point in time, cross-dressing
everything.
Or being transgender.
Yeah, all of that. Mm-hmm. And you can never really run away from who you are. And in the beginning of our marriage, it was really peaches and cream. We called ourselves the A-Team. We ended up moving to Costa Rica in 1991, long before it was known as a destination. Mm-hmm. My ex got a teaching position at the Central Cultural. She earned her MA at Portland State. You know, I walked away from a good job at the symphony, but I was ready for some global travel. I ended up making $2 an hour as an English teacher in Costa Rica, which wasn't very satisfying. I went around different places. I knew that Costa Rica was going to come online as a destination for corporate tourism because of my background in San Diego tourism. I was correct in that analysis. I ended up starting my own company, Costa Rica Incentives, and it took off. All through the 90s, I really scored. And I handled all the corporate groups I got. I handled everything on the ground. I was a ground handler in Costa Rica. All the tours, all the hotels, all the transfers, all the VIP services, all the theme parties. I hired tour guides. I hired a general manager. I was Mr. Costa Rica.
Costa Rica is an amazing country. I actually went there as a teenager in 1987.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, what was really fascinating to me was the McDonald's sold fried chicken.
Oh, yeah. Pizza Hut was there, too.
Yeah. You were early like, what a crazy parallel universe. Yeah. There's no burgers at the McDonald's.
Yeah.
They didn't have burgers
then? They sold fried chicken at the McDonald's. That's what people wanted to eat. So McDonald's was like, they're being a pioneer back in the 80s, you know, moving into those markets.
Right.
And so at the tender age of 50, you decided to transition.
One month.
Why at this point? I mean, you've been through so much.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The marriage in Costa Rica got a little dicey.
Mm.
My ex wanted to come back to the States. I reluctantly agreed to do that. I hated to walk away from my career that I had created in Costa Rica. She was no longer really happy down there. I was able to move Costa Rica Incentives to Oregon and keep it going for another 3 or 4 years with smaller groups, more ecology-based groups, which was fine, but nothing like it had used to be. And so I was traveling a lot back down to Costa Rica. We were separated a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And those feelings started coming back. Those feelings of transgender, wanting to be a woman, they were never really gone. I was still drinking a lot during all those years and smoking a lot of weed. I started to get back into amphedrine, it was called back then, a poor man's speed over
ephedrine,
the counter.
Yeah.
Ephedrine over the counter. It was becoming kind of like a destabilizing influence, not only in my own life, but in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was starting to like really slip again down that slippery slope. Not ever wanting to go back into drug dealing or anything like that, but just drug use.
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, it's like Lady Gaga says this, you never stop being a drug addict.
No, you don't.
And in a sense, like the points that, you know, and some people in recovery, they talk about a halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and I add an extra letter, horny, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Or
that's
we call
right.
it the word is horngry, which
that's
is a combination of all those ideas. And part of it is the idea of the drug is, you know, no one does drugs because it's a responsibility. They do it because it feels good. It's an escape from the circumstances that you are in. And for us to, like, intellectualize that is not the same thing as actually experiencing it, because it really is a get out of jail free card, as Kate Bornstein writes in her memoir, many of her memoirs. And so for you, like at this point in your life, I imagine that there are days and as you, even you're busy, you have this amazing book and this amazing life. But I want to know why relive it all again? Why not just move forward and leave it in the past? Why write this book and put these painful, dangerous circumstances and stories in for everybody, for the world to read?
I wrote the book for two reasons. The first reason, I wanted to help people out there who are in that deep, dark pit that I found myself mm-hmm. in for so many decades, in the closet, using drugs, using alcohol, who felt and feel it's hopeless for them out there and there's no way out of the living hell that they find themselves in. I know they're still out there. I'm positive of that. And I felt writing this book, and hopefully some of these people that will read this book, if I can help just one in this case to get out of where I was, this whole thing will have been worth it. The second reason why I wrote the book was because there's a yearning out there. Things have really changed in the community as far as exposure these past 3-4 years, even further back with transgender, what it means. I want to be able to help raise a level of consciousness and make people more aware of what it means to be transgender. I could have easily not said anything and just slip back into society and been Denise, but I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I felt like I had to tell my story.
It's also interesting, though, because you're portraying an imperfect story, one full of flaws. I mean, you're sort of the transgender Pablo Escobar that didn't succeed, you know. You're very much, in a lot of ways, it's like you could be a character on Orange is the New Black.
I suspect I could be. You're right. Yeah.
And so there's this, and I'm noticing this interesting trend that's happening. So for a while it was like, it was very much a fascination with gender nonconforming performers, right? And certainly the rise of Laverne Cox as a media sensation rode that wave. And one thing that Mark and I are observing too is that trans people, especially trans women, well, not even trans men, are posting pictures of themselves as children before they transition. They're using the names that their parents gave them and sort of dead naming themselves and really trying to sort of tell their story of how they got to this point. And I think actually that's really healthy.
Whereas before it would kind of be like, I don't ever want to see another, I would never post a picture of myself when I presented as male or as I presented as female. And now you see it's like, hey, Throwback Thursday, here it is. And you're like, oh, there it is. And it seems kind of like that's relatively new, I think, for a lot of people.
I have an epiphany moment that I'd like to share with you in regards to what you were just talking about. As you know, for many decades, I kept Denise in the closet. I didn't want anyone to know about Denise. And I did a really good job of doing that for the most part. It was a very secret life, as I like to call it. And that's the way I rolled for decades. So when I transitioned a month shy of my 50th birthday and had my gender-affirming surgery, what was the first thing I did? I kicked Dennis in the closet for the next 11, 12 years. I didn't want anyone to know about Dennis, except friends, because I just was done with that, like you were mentioning here.
You don't want to relive it.
You don't want to relive it. And I was like, I'm just done with this. So all during that time, occasionally I'd be misgendered. Someone would read me. Being read means that somebody knows in public. They can tell for whatever reason. They may be have been exposed to the culture. They may have been in prison themselves, because that role's in prison. They may have a relative who's transgender. So I'd get read, and occasionally an insult would be hurled at me. And I'd be so upset over that. It would ruin my day. I'd call up friends, and I would complain on the phone. I'd be angry, and just, it was very, very rough on me. And then when I finished writing this book and we made progress towards publication, I thought, I had this moment about a year or so ago, and for the first time it dawned on me. I said to myself, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. Let Dennis out. Let Dennis out. Denise, me, I'll always hold center stage for the rest of my life, but there's always going to be a bit part on that same stage for Dennis. And when I came to that realization, was able to accept my true self and my former self as one person, now if that, when that occasionally happens, I don't care anymore. I don't care. It's okay. If that makes you feel better, fine. Say what you want.
And for LGBT people, we're really attracted to theater and performance in many methods of it. And part of it is because we spend our lives sort of hiding who we are. So that language of pretend, of play, it becomes second nature for us, I would say. You know, we're sort of the shamans and the storytellers of our societies. And for you, it's an interesting situation now because, like, you're sort of touring and you're telling these stories. Tell us what you said when you were about your teeth to the book reading, which was so wonderfully funny and outrageous.
Well, last week in Portland, Oregon, I was at Powell's Books, which is one of the internationally famous bookstores in the world. Always busy at Powell's. It was an honor to be invited to speak at Powell's Books.
Sure. It's an institution.
I had an overflow crowd that night, standing room only. I knew it was going to be one of the big nights in my life. And I got up there and I did a very good job of connecting with my audience. That comes from many years in theater, many years of public speaking at the symphony, my business in Costa Rica. Felt very comfortable with all that. And I'm Denise now. I'm Denise. So during the course of this presentation that I did and readings and so forth, I kept noticing my dentist off to the right sitting there. The whole dental clinic came. Dental assistants, the whole, everyone.
Well, considering how much money you spend with them,
he was always smiling. I kept seeing, you know, I got to say something about this. And I said, you know something? Even tonight, my dentist is here. And I'll tell you all something. You see these teeth? And I smiled. You see this beautiful smile? This beautiful smile? Well, from all the years of doing crystal meth and crank and what have you, I ground these teeth down and I needed root canals. My teeth were a disaster. And this, my wonderful dentist here, didn't say his name, fixed everything. These are all crown. These are why I have this beautiful smile. And I'll tell you something. I ended up spending more money on my new teeth than I did on my new vagina. and that got a really good laugh. And I was able to up the laugh by saying, maybe I should switch things around. Maybe my vagina should be up here and my teeth down there. Maybe that would make a difference. But, you know, nobody ever sees the new vagina, so I guess it's okay.
Just handstands.
And the tattoos are gone.
Any
thoughts about bringing them back?
I'd have to go back on the crystal meth for that to happen.
You're not going to get under the needle anymore.
No.
You're ready. Because it's interesting. You're now this kind of like earth pagan goddess.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah.
You know, earth mama kind of. Yeah. Phase in your life.
You look like somebody who's lived in Costa Rica and Hawaii for a number of years.
Yeah, thank you.
And now Oregon.
Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I'll always be a tropical girl. I get cold if it gets below 70.
Mm. What can people hope to learn from reading trans women's stories like yours that are not trans themselves?
Well, I think they like hearing me talk about what it's like to be a woman today and things that I didn't know about before. And let me give you some examples of that. The main example I want to give you is before when I was a man. And I would be in a strange neighborhood and it'd be dark outside. I never worried about where I walked or where I went or anything like that. I never felt threatened. But as a woman, man, did that come home to roost. I remember one time when I was living in Manhattan back in 02, and I was in Chinatown, and it was late. It was like 1:30. I can't remember why I was out there with some friends who had to leave, and I was walking in the subway by myself, and I was like, oh my God, I am so vulnerable right now. I'm in platform shoes. I just felt with a skirt on and I just, in my purse, and I had this overpowering fear hit home with me. And that never used to bother me as a male. And I think I told that story at Powell's, and somebody wrote me the next day and said, you know, Denise, when you told that story, every woman in that audience had your back.
They understood.
They understood immediately what you meant.
Are women of all shapes and kinds starting to understand their shared experience better? Because I feel like, you know, and it was really unfortunate that a lot of especially, you know, lesbian women were for a while, you know, cisgendered lesbian women were sort of defining themselves against other trans women, you know, and especially with the intersection of the TERF, so the trans radical exclusionary feminists. And the especially with the issue with the Michigan Women's Music Festival. And I think in some ways, you know, all good things or all complicated things come to an end to some degree. But I feel like as a society and as a community, we're at a better place.
Yes.
In terms of feminism.
I think you're correct in that. I'm aware of what happened at the music festival. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's still going on. I know a lot of lesbian women in Portland. And I just haven't run across that disclusionary attitude or anything like that. They've been so embracing and so kind and so loving towards me. It made me feel as one of them.
And you saw the third season of Transparent, the character goes into a similar sort of Michigan Women's Music Festival and is triggered.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite an experience. And, you know, it's interesting, like, how much of streaming media like Amazon Prime and Netflix rely on these transgender stories, actors, and experiences to get people, audiences, excited about their content.
I agree. You know, there's another thing that I've talked about, too, on this book tour that I've been on here in the Midwest. All the focus seems to be towards people like myself, transgender women. Transgender men are out there. I know quite a few in Portland. And I feel like the media is ignoring them. You know, they deserve to have their story told, too. It doesn't happen very often when you think about it. All the focus in the media, television, movies, print, my book, it's all geared towards transgender women. And I hope that eventually that balances out a little bit. I wonder
why that is.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Is it the power structure?
It's male privilege, maybe.
Privilege?
It's the idea that they're still seeing you as a man, so you're part of that privileged world. Or there's another thing, too, is that, you know, and one, who is it that her last name is Love? Who she said that a lot of white men, a lot of people who presented as white men, who lived as white men, have a very hard time letting go of that male privilege. And so they tend to later in life come out as trans. Whereas if you're a person of color, it's a lot easier to come out as trans earlier in your life because you feel like you have nothing to lose.
It's a good point.
And so in some ways, it's like, you know, because of the visibility of trans women in media is stemming from that confidence that's coming from the male privilege. And so trans men who presented as female in their earlier parts of their lives may be still struggling with that sort of issue of feminine oppression that they've internalized.
It's true, and they seem so invisible in society right now.
But even now, to add something more complicated, is a lot of young people are saying, you know what, I'm gender non-binary, and I don't want to identify as male or female. I want to be none of the above and all the above.
That's right. You know, Oregon, as you know, is the first state, if I'm not mistaken, in the union to have gender X on their driver's licenses now.
Thanks to our guest and friend in common, Lake James Paraguay.
That's right.
That's how we got to know you.
That's correct.
Lake recommended you to us.
Yeah.
And that pissed off a lot of LGBT civil rights groups who had a lot of money at stake geared up for that fight.
They were going to fundraise.
You know, Lake James Esquire at Paraguay just tiptoed into the courtrooms and there brought marriage equality for $125.
That's right.
And an ex gender non-binary on the driver's license for $300.
Okay.
Yeah, at least to my memory, which is pennies serving for civil rights.
It'll be very interesting to see how the DMV in Oregon, now that you have X as a gender non-binary, how that will be affected on the federal level. Because, I mean, passports, Social Security, all that kind of stuff.
Right. I have a story to share about the first day of that in Oregon. Lake contacted me and said, would you be interested in being my assistant the first day of the DMV when it opens at 8 in the morning? And his idea was to set up a little ironing board with a little sign on it and hand out donut holes to people in line. So I said, yeah, I'll do that.
I think I saw pictures.
I'll do
that. Why the donut holes?
Well, just as a little gift for people standing there. They're good. Mm. I went to
it's
heaven.
It's easy to eat.
Pop it in your mouth.
Yeah, you pop it in your mouth. And I went to Heavenly Donuts and got 200 donut holes that he had pre-ordered. And I showed up there at 7:45. We set up our ironing board. And there was a line of people outside the DMV in downtown Portland. And the media was there.
Yeah.
And so there were transgender. That's when I saw a lot of transgender men that they looked very male to me, and they wanted the X.
Mm.
And they got interviewed by not only Lake, but by the media, and the pure joy on their face was so rewarding to me to see them so happy. It was a big day for them. And on top of that, there were a lot of other people in that same line for other purposes that weren't there for that. And they were curious, what are these donut holes? And we'd tell them. Not one person was upset about the new law. They were just super supportive.
Wait till that new law has ramifications. What happens with passports? What happens when a person with an X on their driver's license goes to another state?
That's what Lake's
for. And has to transfer their driver's license to the new state. It's opening up a huge menagerie of civil rights issues, especially for gender nonconforming people, in the benefit and in the direction of equality. So really, thanks to like James Paraguay Esquire and to the extraordinary transgender community in Portland, Oregon, that really, and in the state of Oregon, that really was pioneering in that.
That's right. Absolutely correct.
Denise Chanterelle Dubois. The book is Self-Made Woman. It's available on Amazon. It's available through our website, feastoffun.com. If you click on the link, we get a little token of love from you guys. And we want to thank you so much for taking the time. I know your schedule is extremely busy. Right.
Could I give out one piece of information?
Sure.
My website?
Maybe. All right.
I'll also put a link up to your website, too.
Oh, okay, yeah. Sure. Selfmadewomanbook.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's amazing photos and interviews and stories.
Everything's there. Yeah.
About
everything.
The book.
Yeah.
So you're traveling. You're going. Where are you going next in your book tour?
The
so
Midwest,
people want to see you in person.
Thank you for asking. The Midwest book tour is concluded with this evening. I'm going back to Portland for a little while, and then I have a publicist, a national publicist, and we're talking all the time. And we're looking at a West Coast swing next, which would be San Francisco, L.A., San Diego, and Phoenix. And then we go through the holidays. And I've already got Blue Stocking's book in New York on the 24th of January and Porter Square Books in Boston on the 26th. And then we're going to build around that with other events on the East Coast. Mm. It'll be an East Coast swing at that time.
In the middle of winter.
I know, and I'm the one who worries about when it's below 70.
Bring a sweater. I want to remind folks that we can't do this podcast without your support, so if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to this show is what makes this show happen.
Please, the podcast you save, it may be your one of your favorite ones, right? Feastoffun.com/donate. Make a one-time donation. You can visit our store, feastoffun.com/store, and get yourself a fabulous Feast of Fun design t-shirt. And first, you know, because if you don't treat yourself to our archives of 13 years of podcasting, you're cheating yourself. You owe it to yourself on these road trips and you're going on airplane rides. You want to load up your portable media player, your iPhone, your Samsung Galaxy Note X, the one that doesn't explode.
Dust off your Zune.
Your iPod Shuffle and load it up with some Feast of Fun goodies. Denise Chanterelle Dubois, I want you to, can you read that quote at the end? here. This is such a lovely thought to finish up with there.
At the very end here, mm-hmm. Denise Chantuel Dubois is an actress, environmentalist, and business...
No, not that one. This one. When I'm dealt a bad day.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Thank you. I really like this. When I'm dealt a bad day or find myself contemplating the what ifs of my future, I am so glad that the biggest what if no longer plagues me or breaks my stride. I'm Denise. That in and of itself makes me feel like fortune's favorite daughter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.